Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
In the winter, if your coop is dry and free of you know, drafts, I mean, you want ventilation, but, you know, drafts, you know, wind whistling through during a snowstorm, then you're fine.
But how do you deal with frozen water bowls? And do chickens need extra heat in their coops? Jana Wilson has all the answers you need. Some suburbs are considering local farms more valuable as neighbors than, say, golf courses. Harvest Public Media talks about that new trend. And then we look back on a great year of interviews and recipes. Some of my favorite recipes were for breakfast dishes and an excerpt of my conversation with Peter Todd about food choice. Then we hold up a microphone in front of the Bread and Roses guys as they teach us about sheet mulching. We're giving our news department a break for the holidays. Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie are still posting stories on the website, though. Check out the year-end wrap-up of the big food news in 2013. We're at eartheats.org. But Harvest Public Media, still hard at work. A story from them to start off this week's program. When you think of moving to a housing development in the suburbs, you might imagine golf courses, swimming pools, and rows of identical houses. But that could be changing. There's a new model springing up across the country that taps into the local food movement. Farms, complete with livestock, vegetables, and fruit trees, are serving as the new suburban amenity. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports.
At first, Bucking Horse looks like your average halfway constructed subdivision. But look closer, and you'll see a rustic red farmhouse and a big white barn.
Yeah, these buildings are beautiful.
Kristen Kirkpatrick works for Bellissimo, the developer that purchased this 240-acre plot of land in Fort Collins, Colorado, to turn it into a neighborhood totally devoted to local food. Bucking Horse will support more than 1,000 households. Some families have already moved in. Townhouses are currently under construction. Condos are planned.
When we show it, people are either like, you guys are crazy. I don't see the vision here at all. Or they come and they're like, this is going to be amazing.
While other developers look to mainstay amenities like golf courses or tennis courts to lure potential homebuyers, Bucking Horse takes a different tack, with agriculture being the big draw. The development has set aside land and is working on hiring its very own farmer.
So the site itself has a 3.6-acre community-supported agriculture, a CSA.
Add in a plaza designed for farmers markets, an educational center where homeowners take canning classes, plus a small livestock operation with goats and chickens. The neighborhood plan is infused with the quaint, pastoral, even romantic view of farming.
Our public restrooms are in an old chicken coop, and it'll be half public restroom and half chicken coop. We're really trying to connect people to where their food comes from at every level.
As the local food movement has taken hold, suburban developers have taken notice, leveraging the movement's in-vogue status to build neighborhoods around farms and ultimately to sell homes.
Traditionally, people have seen land development as being lots and roadways.
Lindsay X is with the City of Fort Collins Planning Department.
But recently, with Bucking Horse being a great example, we've seen people start to incorporate more gardens and more food production opportunities into their developments.
As suburban sprawl took over across the country, farmland was transformed into neighborhoods. And in many cities, restrictive zoning pushed goats, chickens, and tractors out of those new residential areas. Now, though, with growing interest in farming as a community activity, municipalities are being forced to change their codes to bring those things back in.
We used to have residential separated from agriculture, and now we're seeing those uses being combined.
A combination that could bring in big money for developers. Subdivisions that include small-scale farms have sprung up in Illinois, Georgia, Hawaii, and Vermont in the past decade. The Urban Land Institute estimates there are more than 200 developments with an agricultural twist nationwide. Quint Redmond runs a company called Agriburbia, which operates farms within suburban developments across the country. In traditional developments, someone still has to run the golf course. Redmond does the same thing, but with farming. He says this idea of farm as amenity is a great deal for your average small-time farmer.
The best possible thing for a farmer is to have the infrastructure ready. That is where most farming goes upside down or goes broke.
Redmond says it ends up being the developer or homeowners association putting in irrigation lines and making big farm purchases, not the farmer. Not to mention the vegetable fields are completely surrounded by homes filled with people already interested in local food.
So what happens is the farmer may farm that. Everybody gets to see it as they're moving into the subdivision over time. And then there's a real market for that farmer.
Okay, you want to get down?
Back at Bucking Horse in Fort Collins, Lindley Green is coaxing her two young sons to finish their breakfast. The neighborhood's concept attracted Green and her husband to move in earlier this year.
Once we saw this and the plans they had for it, we were really sold on the lifestyle, I would say.
And she's not alone. Bucking Horse's developer says new single-family lots were snatched up within days of going on the market. Values of existing homes have jumped 25% since the agricultural amenities started construction. Green says once the neighborhood farm is up and running, she'll be volunteering to get her hands dirty.
We love the idea of it, but to have it right here and maybe be able to go work at it, but not necessarily have it in our backyard, but still in our backyard is awesome.
And so suburban soccer moms could soon start double dipping as backyard farmers. I'm Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. Read and listen to more stories at harvestpublicmedia.org. The calendar says it's winter, but we had 50-degree weather in Indiana recently. So weird. But we're talking snow and cold today anyway, especially as it relates to your chickens. Jana Wilson is back again, answering your questions. A couple weeks ago, our focus was eggs. When will the chicks start laying? Why have the pullets stopped laying? Another egg conundrum. Her pullet, this brand new chicken farmer's baby, laying teeny tiny little eggs.
Yeah.
So, and she's worried that it's something she's doing wrong.
Right, yeah. And it's probably not, is my answer. When pullets first start laying, their eggs are small. The eggs that they lay often depend on their body weight. And when the pullets are 16 to 24 weeks, they're not fully grown yet. And so the eggs are not as big either. And also, you know, when the reproductive system is getting started, the eggs just sometimes they're a funny shape. Things have to work a little while before they get regulated.
Okay.
So in general, the eggs will get larger. It also depends. You have to feed them a feed that is designed for laying hens. I look for a laying feed that has anywhere from 15 to 17% protein. Calcium has to have calcium because eggshells are made of calcium. And so when the hen lays her egg, her body becomes depleted of calcium and she needs to replenish it.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Sure enough.
Yeah.
We're going to talk more about feed, especially how you deal with feed and water during the winter.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get to that in a second. But this was an interesting question. I loved this. Normally, chickens lay their eggs in coops. But this particular farmer is sort of finding like a hide-and-seek situation with her eggs. Her hens are sort of finding random spots around the yard to lay eggs. So first of all, why do chickens do that?
Well, I think if any of us knew that, we might be, I don't know, wealthy, but we'd be sought after for our advice. I feel the pain. I've had it happen to me. Chickens are creatures of habit until they're not. So first of all, the nesting box in a coop. Let's talk about that. You have to have certain requirements for the hen to lay an egg and feel comfortable. They need to be in a dark, kind of an out-of-the-way place that's away from the rest of the chickens, and they like to feel safe when they lay. So, and the other interesting thing is that they love to lay eggs where other eggs are. Why are they going outside? Who knows? Something's happened. Maybe they were disturbed. Who knows? So if that's a problem, though, and it's happening a lot and you're not getting any eggs in your coop, my advice would be to keep your coop closed until mid-morning if you can, because generally the hens will lay in the morning, you know, up until, say, maybe 10 or 11. If that's possible, that will then encourage them to lay inside, and then you can let them out. You
okay.
know? Yeah.
This time of year, people are worried about winter.
Sure.
The number one threat for your flock in the winter is?
Damp, dampness, wetness, not the cold. Chickens actually can bear cold much better than they can take heat.
Hmm.
Heat is a killer. You know, think of it. They're wearing a down coat. all the time. They stay quite warm in those feathers. I don't know if you've ever seen a chicken in cold weather. They'll puff their feathers up. And what that does is when their feathers are kind of ruffled and puffed up, it traps the warm air from their body and they stay warmer that way.
Sure, yeah.
So in the winter, if your coop is dry and free of you know, drafts, I mean, you want ventilation, but, you know, drafts, you know, wind whistling through during a snowstorm, then you're fine. If your coop gets damp and cold, the chickens can get sick. They can get frostbite on their combs and their feet.
Well, your chickens need water, so I guess we have a couple issues here. Do you keep the water inside? How do you keep it not frozen? How do you keep it from creating a wet, damp coop environment, which you've just said is the killer?
It's bad. Boy, that is my biggest winter challenge.
Really?
Water. Ugh, well, yes. I've used an electric dog dish. Have you seen this from the pet store? You plug them in and they're heated. What you do have to be careful of is that the birds don't splash the water. If you put the water at their about head height, they're going to be less likely to fling the water around. There's something called a stock tank heater, also available at a farm store. They're these little disc, round disc things that you plug in and you put into just a big bowl of water. And they'll keep the water unfrozen as well. And the other thing is you just have to be vigilant. I mean, I'll go to my coops every day and I make sure there is water. And sometimes the electrical water bowls don't work and they have ice. And you have to work – you have to fix that because chickens need water year-round. And so winter is just as important as summer. And, you know, you can't expect them to go out and peck at snow. That's – you know, I've heard of old farmers think letting that happen. And, you know, you just can't do that. You have to give them fresh water all the time.
Well, you mentioned this sort of in passing, so let's talk about it. You don't use a heat lamp. You don't heat your coop.
No.
Why not?
I just think it's healthier for the birds not to heat. In my larger coops, I use an oil-filled radiator heater. Heat lamps can be very dangerous. If it falls down into something or is near something flammable, it will start a fire.
I wonder if people think that because they have the image of chicks under the heat lamp when they're very, very young. And maybe all chickens want that. Maybe that's where that comes from.
They might. They might.
You know, I don't know.
You know, the other issue is that if you heat your coop all the time, what happens if the electricity goes out? You know, suddenly the birds don't have that heat and it might be harder for them to adapt. Mm-hmm. Chickens, for the most part, most breeds are very hardy. They're happy outside.
All right. Jana Wilson, thanks.
You're welcome.
Jana Wilson writes posts for us about raising chickens and all the joys and difficulties that come with it. Read her articles at eartheats.org. Late December, that means it's a great time for citrus. Chef Daniel Orr has a big bowl of some familiar fruits and a couple unusual ones.
These are miniolas, and you can cut, they've kind of gotten a little outy belly button on them. Then you've got a tangerine. This is a Meyer lemon. You can see it's a little bit different. It's less wrinkly. It's kind of smooth on the exterior than the normal lemon. And it's got a much sweeter flesh. And you can actually eat the peel of this.
Really?
So it's really good. Then we've got the grapefruit. And then we've got a pomelo, which is kind of an Asian grapefruity citrus fruit. Now, what a lot of people do is they just go ahead and throw away the grapefruit skin or the orange peels. You can also make candies out of it. The French do candied orange and citrus peels where you blanch it in several turns of water. So you get rid of a lot of that bitterness, and then you cook it down in a very thick sugar syrup, and then finally, you know, when they cool down, you can toss them in some granulated sugar, and they're great to serve with coffee after dinner.
And we're wasting so much less if you actually use this.
I heard you didn't like grapefruit. So today we're going to come up with a grapefruit dish that hopefully you will like. Kind of like a grapefruit brulee. So basically all we do is we'll cut the grapefruit in half, and this is the ruby red grapefruit, which tend to be sweeter than a normal grapefruit. Cut this around the peel, so you're just doing kind of a circle, just kind of releasing the grapefruit from the peel, but leaving it inside. And then if you want to be fancy, you can go through and cut between each one of those little segments, and that will really make it easy to eat if you have a grapefruit spoon. All right, so then what we do is we take a little brown sugar. We're going to just kind of coat this with the brown sugar and then put it up under the broiler. If you have one of those little blow torches, you can also just use a little blowtorch on it, and you want it to caramelize. All right, so I'm going to just go put it up under the broiler. All right, and we're going to make this little broiled grapefruit into something a little more adult. I've got some griotines, which are brandied French cherries.
All right.
They're seedless sour cherries and a sugar brandy syrup. All right, I'm just going to put this in the serving dish. We'll put a few of these cherries on top, maybe just a little touch of the liquid, and that's it. That's our wonderful broiled grapefruit, and it'll make a grapefruit lover out of even the most timid of citrus people.
So it's the tartness, the pucker factor that I just don't like about grapefruit. But this dish almost changed my mind. If you love grapefruit, this one's definitely a winner. See the recipe and a picture at eartheats.org. Coming up, we had an awesome year talking to researchers and visiting farms and, of course, eating lots and lots of amazing food. Three highlights from 2013 up next. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all four locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Lots of authors and researchers visited our studios in 2013. Let's start our year in review with Peter Todd, a professor of cognitive science, psychology, and informatics at Indiana University. I spoke with him following his talk at Big Red Eats Green. One of the things that really struck me was, as consumers, we're bombarded with all of this information when we're at the grocery store, trying to pick the package of cream cheese that we want to buy, the color of the label, where it's located in the store, the calorie count, what the ingredients list includes. But what I took from your talk is that as consumers, we actually use only a couple bits of information to make choices in the grocery store as compared to all the different bits of information that are thrown at us. Can you talk about that?
That's absolutely right, that when we are confronting our common everyday food choices, most of the time we're making those choices on the basis of habit and familiarity. So we don't need to use and we don't use the new information that might be available to us. People very rarely pick up a package and look at the ingredient list or the nutrition information on the side. And they most often are looking for things that they've already had before. And so all it takes to do that is name brand recognition or knowing where in the store they had bought the item the previous time they were in there.
So I don't even know if you can speak to this, but as you know, people who are trying to change the way people eat, get away from high salt, high fat foods, highly processed foods, go to more local foods, if people are just going to buy from their habits, are we fighting a losing battle?
So what needs to be done then is to somehow inspire or shock people into seeing the choice now as a new, different thing that they need to do to make in the store. So somehow change the situation so that they do become conscious of the choice and go beyond just looking for what they always get. And one way of doing that is to inform people that there are new products and that they should have a look at them. So having displays in stores with something new that people haven't seen before, that's an occasion on which people will investigate more and will try to get more information. They might try a free sample. They might look at the ingredients on the package and see, okay, this new thing, is it something that I want to add to my diet?
I was reading a little bit through the study that you published, and it said something along the lines of consumers can make good choices with less information. What is good? What does good choice mean?
So good choice can be a difficult thing to try to define exactly, because there's different dimensions that we could measure goodness on, and different people will be using different dimensions on different occasions. So a good choice for entertaining may involve different kinds of foods from a good choice for making your child's lunch or for having a daily breakfast. But the kinds of things that you could make a good choice on the basis of would be nutritional content in some cases. It would be special good taste in other cases, like when you're entertaining. So overall, there are these different dimensions that we could measure goodness on, but how we go about judging that goodness can still, on each of those dimensions, involve rather few pieces of information.
We went on to talk about how a smart shopping cart could help consumers make these sorts of good decisions. Peter Todd gave us a sneak peek into something that's just in the prototype phase right now. We also got our hands dirty this past year. I could visit Bread and Roses Gardens literally every week, and they'd be doing something different. When I stopped by last March, it was sheet mulching. They were trying to beat back some grasses. It sounded pretty involved to me, but Salem Willard was very practical. He's joined in a bit by Jonas Carpenter.
Rip it out. Put in something that you can eat, you know?
It's really that simple?
Well, there are a lot of strategies for getting rid of grass.
Yeah.
I mean, here on the property, we didn't have a lot of sod to deal with, and we use pigs to till up. But typically, we're trying to avoid the use of tillage, which is a typical way people do get rid of grass, or think they get rid of grass. They till it in and it comes back up, and it's weedy. And so often our strategy to get rid of grass would be to sheet mulch, or some people call it lasagna gardening, where you use biomass or carbon materials like cardboard, newspaper, leaf materials. Like in the tropics, they would use banana leaves. And then the use of lots of wood chips, grass clippings, leaves, things like that, essentially to kind of snuff the grass out.
Then you establish a living ground cover. It could attract beneficial pollinators or deter pests. Anything that serves to snuff out the grass, really. Today, the guys are doing some sheet mulching, not to get rid of grass, but just to prepare the soil to be planted. They're transforming one of the slopes on the property into raised garden beds.
So up here, we're starting a new terrace. We're kind of working up the hillside slowly and trying to accommodate plants that want a little bit of a higher and drier location. In this case, we're planting goji berries, which is also known as wolfberry. Very desirable product because the berries have a lot of essential amino acids, high in beta carotene. They're known as a superfood, and they cost a lot at market. No one can grow them locally, so we're doing it though. I mean, we found that they pretty much grow just like a blackberry would, and they really want a high, dry location. They don't mind sandy soils, clayey soils. They're very adaptable. So we're going to put a few in the ground.
Well, you're standing on, a pizza box and some junk mail. What on earth does this have to do with a garden?
Well, this is the sheet mulch. This is what we'll be using to block out weeds, block out grass from coming back in the short term. In the long term, the living ground covers, the living mulch, basically, will be in place, and that will prevent new weeds from going up.
So literally, you just put this, the paper and the cardboard down, and it...
Yeah, so right now, Jonas is putting a goji in the ground here, and what we're going to do is add a layer of sheet mulch around the plant to provide a little buffer zone to keep other weeds from going back and in that space.
But we're also going to plant in ground covers, so that's our aim, is let them quickly establish and take over and outcompete the grasses.
podcasting. So.
Oh, yep.
Jonas Carpenter and Salem Willard will be back with us in late January talking about composting. We talked about food, we grew food, and now we eat food with Chef Daniel Orr.
Those are chia seeds. Cha-cha-cha-chia. Seriously, that's what they are.
Yep, the same stuff that grows hair on those chia pet terracotta planters. Those novelty items might be a thing of the past, but the chia seeds themselves are enjoying new life as one of the latest it foods for the health conscious. They're small, think of sesame seeds, and very expensive, over $10 a pound. But they do pack a nutritional punch, high in omega-3 fatty acids, protein, fiber, and antioxidants. Once they've been soaked overnight, Chef Orr insists they are really tasty.
Can pack in more flavorful punch. I'm a little skeptical about them adding a flavorful punch because it looks like you've soaked it in some soy milk there, and it just sort of looks like a gelatinous glop.
Well, it looks kind of like rice pudding, you know.
So or rice pudding.
You've got to think of it in pleasant terms. The chia seeds actually absorb a lot of water, and then they don't give the water back to your body very easily. So that means it makes you feel full and content for a long period of time. Okay, and basically what you do is you take 2/3 cups of the chia seeds, you pour over about 2 1/4 cup of whatever kind of milk you want, and then you let them sit for 24 hours. Overnight at least, 24 hours is even better. And what you come up with is this kind of rice pudding looking mixture. So staying with our kind of a vegan theme, we're going to use the agave to sweeten it. We're going to add just a little touch of lemon juice.
Straight from the lemon. You made a point to slice a lemon open, so you're not using stuff from the jar.
Oh, no. That stuff doesn't taste like lemon to me. And the lemon is going to give it that little acid kick to just give our flavor complexity. Then we're just going to dish this out, and what's going to make it look a lot better is the fresh fruit we put on top. So got a couple bowls here. I'm going to put a few kumquats on here, against getting that citrus flavor, a few blueberries, and a few blackberries, and then put a little green mint on there. And that's as simple as it is. And give chia pets a chance.
Give chia pets a break.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a fun one. 2013 was a very good year. Listen to these complete interviews and see even more recipes at eartheats.org. And hey, here's a New Year's resolution for you. Subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss a thing in 2014. Search for Earth Eats on iTunes. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Aabon Binder, Jonas Carpenter, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Peter Todd, Chad Bouchard, Salem Willard, Jana Wilson, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 4 locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage and hatha yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Back with a fresh new show next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.